Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer, by night, but I find no rest. You have David saying, God, I have been crying out to you, I want you to save me, and I'm getting nothing. There is no answer, there's no response. By day I cry out, by night I get no rest. Where are you? Kind of the same cry, isn't it? So what's the difference then between what we're getting in Psalm 22, which by the way is echoed by Jesus when he's hanging on the cross, and what we're listening to when we listen to that song by the Frey? Cruz? Well, and notice on this one, he's not accusing God in the same way that the author of the Frey is accusing God in You Found Me. And the part that we haven't looked at yet, look how he ends this psalm. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted you and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. At the end of the day, the author of the Frey song has no hope. He's despairing because he wanted God to fix this broken relationship that he had, and God didn't show up. David is crying out, God, I don't know where you are, but I know this. You have always been faithful, and therefore I can trust you. Even though I don't see how you're answering me, I don't see how you're coming into my life, how you're responding in my world, I know that you have, and I know that you're true to your promises. So I will put my trust in you as well. That's the difference. The author of the Frey is just, God, you're a jerk. You didn't show up when I wanted you to. And he kind of leaves it there. But David goes back to the promises and the faithfulness and the character of God. He grounds himself in who God is, not in his circumstances. Whereas the author of the song is grounding himself in his broken relationship, and that's destroyed his whole life. And that makes all the difference in the world. And so their worldviews are fundamentally different, even though their messages are about the same. And so as we go through, we're going to be looking at lots of different worldviews over the next 6 weeks. And there's a lot of things that sound the same as we go along, but fundamentally what matters is where the person is grounded as they are thinking about all of the circumstances of life. So that's what we're going to be looking at. So I'm going to be taking you through a series of questions that come from this book, The Universe Next Door by James Sire. It was originally intended for college students who are getting ready to be done with college to get them ready for interacting in the world around them. And what Sire did when he first wrote the book is he came up with 7 questions that he believed every worldview answered. Well, he's done, I think, 10 different editions of the book since that first printing. So he's modified his worldview definition, and he's added an 8th question, and we're going to go through all of those this morning. To try to go as fast as possible and yet explain the questions to you, what we're going to do this morning is we're going to go through all 8 questions, his worldview definition, and we're going to see how both Christian theism and deism answer these questions. The reason for that is next week what I hope to do is go into a specific part of deism that is prevalent in the modern church called moralistic therapeutic deism. We're going to talk about how that's kind of the American religion and see how it even rubs off on us from time to time. And what I want us to be thinking as we go through this whole series is my thinking primarily grounded in the character and the nature of who God is and his promises, or am I basing myself on something else? Am I pulling from these other worldviews in the ways that I think about things? Because I think it's good for us to realize none of us are consistent in the way that we think about the world. We all fall apart at some point. But the more we can be logically consistent in the way that we think about who God is and what he's done and all of that, I think the better off we're going to be. So let's go through. Here's Sire's definition of a worldview. It's kind of long. I've got it on your sheets for you there so you can follow along. A worldview is a commitment, a fundamental orientation of the heart that can be expressed as a story or in a set of presuppositions, and he defines presuppositions for us as assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, that we hold, consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality, and that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. So that's kind of what we're talking about when we talk about a worldview. There's lots of other ways that people have defined worldview. The easiest and simplest definition I've ever heard is a worldview is like a pair of glasses that you put on, and it colors the whole world in the way that you look at it. So if you have glasses that are the right prescription, you can see clearly. If you have glasses that are not, then any of you that wear glasses or contacts like me, you know what it's like when you don't have your glasses or contacts on. The world looks a little different. When I take my contacts out at night, it's basically this giant blur, and you know, I just kind of feel my way through the room until I get to my glasses if I don't have them right next to me. A bad worldview can do that to you as well, that you can stumble through life not being able to figure out what's going on. All right, so the first question that Sayer asks is, what is prime reality, or what is most real? So at the base, this question is getting to, when everything else is stripped away, what is that thing that exists before everything else exists? What is the chief thing that is most important to this worldview? For Christian theism, the answer is a triune God. For deism, you still have God there, but God is what is many people have referred to as the clockmaker God, that he's a cause of everything, but other than that, he has nothing to do with the world. He just kind of gets everything started and lets it run. So God winds up the world and disappears, and when I have time in my class, the song that I always play that's really cheesy, and that's why I play it, because I like to see the kids cringe as it's on the speakers, is the Bette Midler song, the From a Distance, God is Watching Us. That's deism, right? That from a distance, everything looks great. God's out there having a great time by himself. He doesn't bother with us. And he's caused everything, and it's just kind of running down until it stops, just like a watch. For Christian theism, however, we get into the question, what do we mean by a triune God? Sayer defines God as a triune, transcendent and immanent, omniscient, sovereign, and good, which I think is a pretty good definition of all the things that we believe about God as Christians. But I always go through with my students the Westminster Shorter Catechism answer on this. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. Now, if we had time, we'd go through and talk about all the different attributes and see what we mean by all of that. But thankfully, Lauren has spent a lot of time on the Westminster Confession for us, and so we don't need to do that. But at its root, we have to believe in a triune God, not just a God. Because we're going to see as we get into these various worldviews, deism believes in a God, Islam believes in a God, Eastern pantheistic monism sort of believes in a something you might call God. And in our world, one of the things that you quickly discover, especially if you're dealing with college students, is that a lot of them will say, oh yeah, I'm very spiritual, I believe that there's a higher power. But what that means when you start getting down to the details is very different than what we mean when we say we believe in the God who's revealed himself in Scripture. And if we don't believe in a triune God, it's going to affect kind of the way we think about things when we get to what it means to be created in the image of God. So he has to be triune. He's both transcendent and immanent. What does that mean? Yeah, he's above, beyond, he's holy, set apart, right? He is not his creation, but he's also with his creation. He is Emmanuel, God with us. He made himself known to us. He revealed himself. He became one of us. So Christianity is one of the, well, it is the only religion, really, that balances what you see in all of the other world religions. Either they focus too much on the transcendence of God, where God is so far out there, like in deism, that he has nothing to do with us, or there's so much on the immanence of God, as in Hinduism, where God is part of the world. God is this chair. God is Dan Betka. God is all of us. And the immanence of God becomes so important that you lose the distinction of God as something other than we are. In Christianity, you have both of those things. He's omniscient. He knows all things. He's sovereign. He controls all things. And both of those would be terrifying if we didn't have the last one, that he is good. There is nothing that God does that is evil. And we're going to get to that a little bit when we get to the sixth question. Okay, the second question, what is the nature of external reality, the world around us? Christian theism defines the universe as an open universe created by God and a universe that follows the laws of cause and effect generally, but is open to reordering both by man and by God. Meaning our decisions actually have an effect on the world around us. We're not controlled by our biology the way that naturalism, we're going to look at in a couple weeks, says. We're not doing everything as an illusion, so what we do doesn't really matter. The choices that we make, the decisions that we make, actually matter in this life. It's important that when God says, choose life or choose death, obey me or don't, that that's a real choice, and we actually have to decide, will we follow God or will we follow someone else? But it also means that God has interaction with the world, and it allows for miracles. It allows for God to reorder things. When Joshua's fighting and the sun stands still in the sky, that's not a normal thing. It's not something that we typically have happen, and we're really glad for that in the middle of Texas summer, that the sun doesn't just stick up there, right? Sometimes it feels that way. But God is able to reorder things. He's able to intervene in his creation. Deism, it's a closed system. God has started it, and then he has left it, and there is no interference with it. And so ultimately, everything is working. And that's why he's called a watchmaker God, because it's just like a clock. All the pieces turn, and everything happens because of something else. It's just cause and effect. That's important because deism was the step that moved us from the Christian understanding of this open system where we actually, what we did mattered, to naturalism where we watch a video with my high school students that Ben Stein did called Expelled, and it's talking about how the kind of evolutionary perspective is the only thing that's allowed in higher education. And he interviews this one professor who says, the logical conclusion of what I believe is that there is no free will. There can't be. You can't choose anything that you do because your biology determines who you are. You are just the collection of molecules bumping around inside of you, and you do what you do because the world is the way that it is, and that's it. There's no hope. There's no life after death. There's no anything. And that's where you get when you close that system off and God is no longer a part of it. Make sense? All right, so what does it mean then to be human is the third question. It's very important as we're thinking about our worldview that we understand who we are in relation to those other two questions. We may believe that God is the most real thing. We may believe that we live in an open system, but if we get this wrong, we can come up with some really bad theology and philosophy. So, one of the ways you see that happen in the Christian life is if we emphasize too much our fallenness, or if we emphasize too much our created in the image of God without the fallenness, we can run into problems. Does that make sense? I think sometimes the prosperity gospel and some of the self-help kind of versions of Christianity tend to focus more on the you're created a wonderful creation of God too much without recognizing that there's this fallenness and brokenness of sin. I think our problem as Presbyterians is often the opposite. I think we like to wallow in our brokenness and fallenness, and sometimes we forget that God created us good in his image and that we are image bearers of the sovereign Lord over all things. And I think a proper Christian understanding balances both of those. The phrase that I like to keep in my students' minds when we're talking about this is, we are glorious ruins. That How many of y'all have ever been overseas and looked at things like the ruins in Rome or Athens or someplace like that? When you're walking around, you get the sense of the majesty and the beauty and the power that those buildings must have held when they were first created. But there's also kind of a sadness that there's this kind of fallenness and brokenness to those buildings, that they're crumbling and there's very little left of them. That's us. We are glorious ruins. That we have the image of God in us. We were created to be like Him. And yet sin has drastically destroyed and marred that image in real and significant ways. So as we think about the way we relate to each other, that matters. Because if we're a fallen being in God's image, we have to realize that when we're dealing with other people, we're dealing with fallen beings made in God's image. And too often what happens is we don't treat people as if they are people. We treat them as if they are objects to be used rather than people to be valued. Does that make sense? And what I said about it's important about God's character for what we do with this one, if we believe that God is who He is and we are made in His image, then that's going to mean some things for us. One, it's going to mean that we have personality. And I always get this kind of duh kind of look from my students when I talk about this. What personality means is that you are you and you're not somebody else. And they're like, well, of course that's what it means. That's stupid. But isn't that the reason that most of us get into conflict with somebody else? When I first met Josh, my assumption when we were Skyping via the search committee call was that Josh assumed a lot of the same things that I assumed. That he would answer things the same way that I would answer things. And one of the reasons you do interviews when you're doing these kinds of things is because that's not true. Not everybody is like you. And a lot of times when you meet new friends, what you do is you assume that they're going to have a lot of the same interests or same responses to things that are going on in the world around you as you, and they don't. And then you get mad because they're not you. Right? But we should expect that if we believe that we're all created in the image of God, that we each have a unique personality that is our own and not somebody else's. And so part of understanding what it means to be part of the body of Christ is recognizing this fact, that God has created each of us to contribute something to His body, and it's going to be different from the person sitting next to us in the seats around us. Yeah, Josh. Yes. Yeah, and that's one of the things that we talk about in great detail in my class is we spend a lot of time, what does it mean for God to be triune? Well, one of the things is He had perfect relationship with Himself throughout all eternity past. He didn't need us. He didn't have to create us. He was perfectly sufficient all by Himself because He wasn't all by Himself. He had all three persons of the Trinity that He had perfect communion and love with throughout all eternity past. So if we're created in God's image, it means that we are created for community because God is a communal God. It's one of the implications of God being triune. So we can't just say, you know what, it's just me. And I'm good, leave me alone, I'm a rock, I'm an island, and an island feels no pain, and right? We're not Simon and Garfunkel here. So we are created to be in communion with one another. We are created to have relationship with one another. And the way that we begin to do that is understanding who we are created in God's image. Because we do share in His character. We do share a sense of goodness. We do share in a sense of creativity. We have all of these different characteristics that God has, which if we had time to go through all of those individually, we would. But we share those things because we are created in the image of God, but they're marred. They're defaced by our sin and by the brokenness that came into this world through the fall. Make sense? Deism, on the other hand, says we're a natural being endowed with reasonable thought. What makes us human is that we reason. Animals don't reason, we do. That's what makes us human. So to be more human, you have to reason more. And there's some truth in that, right? God has endowed us with reason. But for the deist understanding of things, it's all about the human mind. Discovering things through your mind, figuring everything out, reasoning from known propositions to unknown propositions, that's kind of the chief goal of the deistic world. Do y'all have any questions on or thoughts on the what is a human being before we move on? Okay. This is the one that most Christians understand best about Christianity, because in most churches this is the thing that is taught most often. And it's what happens to us when we die. And Christian theism says we either go to heaven or hell, our soul lives on after the body dies, and eventually, which I didn't write this on there because I was trying to save space, eventually the new heavens and new earth will be created, we will be given bodies once again, because we were created to be physical beings. We were created to have both body and soul. Deism, it depends. You have two versions of deism. One's a kind of what they call a hot version of deism. The other one's a cold version of deism. Hot means you see deists that kind of believe that God has some relationship to his creation, even though he's kind of left it alone. And they tend to believe in heaven. And in that case, most people go to heaven because God's not uncaring enough to send people to hell in that version. Or you have the cold version that's just like, well, there's nothing that happens to you when you die, you just die. And it's closer to what we'll talk about in 2 weeks, which is naturalism, that just says you're food for worms when you die and that's it. There is no hope. The best you can hope for is kind of the Lion King interpretation of life, which says, you know, it's the great circle of life. You die and you get eaten by something else later on because you decay and become part of the ground. And that's the cold version of deism and naturalism and existentialism and nihilism and several of the other ones that we'll talk about briefly. How is it possible to know anything at all? This is a question of a branch of philosophy known as epistemology. And it's basically asking the question, what is the basis for human knowledge? Why do we even have the ability to know things? I like to play with my students' minds when we first get onto this question in class, and I start asking them questions like, how do you know you're really sitting here listening to me right now and not at home dreaming that you're sitting in class listening to me talk about epistemology? And they start trying to come up with various answers about how they can trust their senses. And then my question is, well, how do you know you can trust your senses? How do you know when you look at this, you're actually seeing a chair and not something that your mind is telling you is a chair, even though it's really not? If we don't have a basis for knowledge, then everything starts to fritz out and we can get into kind of this weird schizophrenic mindset very quickly. We have to have a basis for the knowledge that we have, a confidence that we can actually trust what our eyes and our hands and our ears and our nose and our mouth all tell us, or we're going to be in serious trouble. So Christian theism answers this question by saying we are created as reasonable creatures who can learn about God and the world through revelation and reason. And then we typically divide that revelation up into two categories. Who knows what they are? Say it again. Yeah, special and natural, or it's sometimes called general revelation as well. That you have the revelation of the world around us. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. That's general revelation. We can see things about God, and we can see things about the world. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. But there's things we can't know without God specifically revealing them to us through special revelation, that is through his scriptures primarily. We wouldn't know that God is triune unless he revealed that to us. We wouldn't know that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by him without God revealing that to us through his scriptures. And so the basis for our knowledge is that we have a God that we serve who is all-knowing and is the source of all being and knowledge. And so, just like David did in that psalm we looked at the beginning this morning, we can trust that our knowledge is secure because we trust in a God who knows all things. So even if we don't know it, we know that he does. which means because God is unchanging, we can study things scientifically and know that there's going to be certain rules that apply in things and all of that. The problem is when you get rid of God, as you start to see with deism when they start pushing him out, and then in naturalism when they get rid of him altogether, it kills the basis for scientific knowledge. Now, they don't realize that right away, but ultimately what happens is once God is pushed out of the picture, even science becomes impossible. Because what they're having to do once they push God out of the picture is borrow from Christianity to have a principle that says, I can study the world because it's orderly and stable and not chaotic and unknowable. But if God is not there, that's all we can hope for, is chaotic and unknowable. So if we don't have God, we don't have science. And you're starting to see this in some of the scientific philosophy and things that are even being taught in the universities now, that ultimately even the basis for science itself is unknowable. And we can't really trust much of anything that anybody says because all of language is a game anyway, which is kind of a scary place to be. Deism, on the other hand, says the universe has order. God created it very orderly, and man can study it with his reason. Revelation, generally, is not given much weight when it comes to knowledge. Y'all have any thoughts about knowledge before we move on? Or if you don't know, that's okay. The question that gets my students more than any other is this question. Not how do we know right from wrong, but can we know right from wrong? I did an informal poll of the 53 juniors that I'm teaching this year, and these are Christian families, mostly Christian students. And I asked the question, is right and wrong something that is always true no matter what? Or is it based on what you believe in your individual situation? And I would say over half, and in one class I think it was about 75% of my students said it's based on what you believe. It's based on the situation, not on some universal right and wrong that's always right and always wrong. And that was the consensus at students at a Christian school that are raised in generally Christian homes, by believing parents. This is the number one question that causes Christians to look judgy to the world. Because Christianity teaches that there is an absolute right and wrong because it's based in the character and the nature of who God is. And we don't have the right to change the definition of something just because we don't like it or we feel that it should be some way else. And most of our culture is opposite to that. Most of our culture believes that morality is relative. Morality changes based on the person and the culture and the time. And you just have to kind of go with the flow. You just have to kind of adjust as the culture adjusts. So 15 years ago, most of the population disagreed with homosexual marriage, so we should too. Now they don't, so we shouldn't either. And if you stay on a particular topic and say, no, I think that the Bible says it's this way, then you're obviously not caring for those people around you. You're not loving them. And you can't call something sin and still love somebody. That's kind of the way our culture thinks about it. Because it doesn't believe that morality is absolute. But if morality is based in the character and the nature of who God is, then it doesn't matter how many votes we get for a particular perspective. Because if it violates the nature and the character of God, then it's wrong. And if it goes along with the character and nature of God, it's right. And so as Christians, I think that's one of the things that we have to be able to talk about, but talk about it in a way that's winsome. You have to be able, because everybody actually believes this. Even the people that say Christians are a bunch of judgmental bigots, what do they have as their prime good? Not being a judgmental bigot. And it's always good to not be a judgmental bigot. So there's an absolute going on even in the way that they formulate that. Everybody has an absolute. It's the question of where is the line drawn? What are the absolutes? And as Christians, we have to be able to talk about this in a meaningful way so that we can say, you know, I get that this is who you think you are, or this is what you think you should be doing. But let me introduce you to the nature and the character of the God that I serve, and begin a conversation that way. Do y'all know the story about Rosaria Butterfield? She wrote a book called The Confessions of an Unlikely Convert. She's actually going to be speaking at Grace in February, I think, which hopefully we can advertise that and get a bunch of people over there because she'll be great to listen to. But she was a professor. I don't remember which university she taught at. Does anybody, Cruz, do you remember? Okay. She taught at a university. She was a lesbian. She taught, was it just feminist or was it also lesbian studies? Well, she was doing women's studies for sure, but she was doing it from a feminist, mostly lesbian perspective. She was a strong advocate for the homosexual lobby and really was pushing for a lot of the things that we see kind of being enacted in our culture now. And over the course of her time at the college, she was befriended by a PCA pastor. Was he not PCA? Okay, as a Reformed pastor. Anyway, befriended by this pastor, and over the course of time, this guy just kept inviting her and her girlfriend over to his house for meals and different things, and was not trying to do anything other than just befriend her. And she was so angry at first that she thought he would be trying to convert her, and like the whole thing just confused her, that she began to kind of read into the scriptures to see how she could eventually have this conversation that she assumed was coming. And through the course of reading through the scriptures, through the time spent with this family, God began to actually work in her heart and transformed her. And she's now married, I believe, to a pastor. Is that right? I think that the guy that she married is a pastor now, and has written this book about her conversion and has written several articles on Christianity Today in different places about how God has completely shifted her thinking in so many ways since she became a Christian. And what she discovered as she kind of walked through that journey was the thing that caught her was Christians demonstrating love and never really beating her up over who she was, but not really saying, you know, it's okay if you're like this. Just loving her. Showing her the gospel through the way that they lived and operated. And ultimately, that led to her being converted. Obviously, the Holy Spirit had major impact in that. You know, it wasn't just men alone. But that is something that we've got to pay attention to when we're thinking about morality as absolute. We don't just come in and start whacking people over the head with, you know, morality is absolute, you slobs. Figure it out. But it does mean we do have to realize that Christian morality is based in who God is. And it's not going to change just because our culture has changed. And God calls us to be faithful even in the midst of all of that. Josh? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you think you're bad, you ought to see what I think about and do and how I treat my wife. And yeah, I mean, it's generally, sometimes I do it poorly, sometimes I do it well, generally the way that I try to deal with students who come in and are confessing crazy sins to me. And did something just happen or am I having a stroke? It's like the whole sound just got crazy on me. But yeah, I mean, I had a conversation with a student at the football game on Friday night, and he's trying to counsel a friend, a girl, who is addicted to pornography. He's like, I don't know how to start. I was like, well, you got to start by being able to listen and recognizing that everybody has the things that they struggle with. And that's going to be the thing that's going to get them to be able to talk in such a way that they'll want to come out of that sin. So, yeah, I mean, relating to them with humility is huge. All right, we got to go quickly because we're already out of time. Deism, morality follows the laws of nature and can be discerned by all reasonable men. So we just look at the world around us, and if you reason correctly, you can figure out what's right and wrong. The problem is it doesn't actually work that way because everybody looks at nature and figures out different things because of what Romans 1 says. We take the truth that God has revealed to us and we suppress it. We exchange the truth for a lie. What is the meaning of human history? Question 7. Christian theism says that we exist in a linear time frame. History has started at a place and it's going somewhere. And it follows this pattern of creation, fall, and redemption with eventual restoration of all creation. That there's an end point that God is driving us to. It just doesn't go on meaninglessly for all time and eternity. There will be a time when God brings time to an end in that sense. And he restores all the things that were broken by the fall. Deism, it's the opposite. It's just entropy. It's a winding down clock. Eventually, everything ends cold and dead and energy's gone and nothing's moving and life is set. Last question. What personal life-orienting core commitments are consistent with this worldview? In other words, what is at the heart of what your worldview is saying? For Christian theism, I don't think there's a better answer than Westminster Confession number 1, or Shorter Catechism number 1. What is man's chief end? Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. That should be the thing that is driving and motivating us as we follow Christ and as we understand who God is. That our purpose in life is to enjoy and glorify God in the way that we live. And so that's going to enable us, motivate us, to take every thought captive as we think about the God that we serve, which is why theology is so important for Christians. It's something I have to try to convince my students of because most of them, when they hear the word theology, they think boring, unimportant, something that only theologians should do. It's great for pastors, but I don't want to have anything to do with it. But the question I always ask them, I said, what if I asked you the question, do you believe in X? And they look at me like, well, what's X? I said, exactly. You can't say you believe in something if you don't know what that something is. So you can't say, I follow Christ, I believe in God, if you don't know who God is and who Christ is. You have to have substance to that, and theology is important for us as Christians to know who God is so that we can glorify and enjoy him. Deism, again, it depends on the warm versus the cold. And there's different answers to that, but they typically fall under the lines of use your reason to make the most out of your life and find what is best for you rationally, which is not very satisfying at the end of the day. So next week we'll get into moralistic therapeutic deism, which is a more modern version of deism. I wanted you to have kind of the framework of philosophical deism first, and we'll get into some of the ways that moralistic therapeutic deism infects the church and what we do about it.